Pete Rose logged more hits in baseball history than anyone else. No one has come close to breaking his record. But he was also at the center of one of the game's biggest scandals, a scandal that changed baseball forever. In the new book, Charlie Hustle, New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien chronicles Pete Rose's spectacular rise and fall. Drawing on firsthand interviews with Rose himself and his associates, this is Pete Rose as we've never seen him before. By Charlie Hustle, available wherever books are sold.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
In 2017, the CDC released a report that noted that more than half of female homicide victims in the United States were killed by intimate partners. While a lot of the focus of crime reporting, especially in the true crime community, might be on stranger kidnappings or stranger murders, these crimes often distract us from the truth that you're more likely to be harmed by someone you know, and for at least half of those victims, by someone they're married to, dating, or are related to. We've certainly covered our fair share of stranger crimes, but in this episode, we discuss the horrifically violent murder of Idema Cerny by her husband, Gus Cerny, in 1932. Welcome to this episode of California True Crime. My name is Jessica, and I'm here with Sean and Charles. How are you guys doing?
Doing great. Great. Thanks for asking.
I'm doing good, too.
We'll be giving you the details of this crime that spans the areas of Los Angeles, the Mojave Desert, and even Chicago, Illinois. I used a lot of different newspapers in California and Illinois, and you can find a full citation for this episode on our website at californiatruecrime.com. Before I get started, I do want to tell you two things. First, this episode will include a murder committed by an intimate partner, and we will have a discussion about intimate partner violence. This may be difficult for some to listen to, and if that's you, you may want to skip this episode. The second is a really frustrating issue I had when researching this episode. I came across this crime while researching for another case. And one of the first things I do when putting together information for the episodes is compile as much information as I can on both the victim and the perpetrator. This case took place in the 1930s, so there wasn't a lot of personal information about the victim, although we see that in a lot of more modern cases as well. But what I didn't expect was that there was very little information about what her name was. In fact, each newspaper I came across had different spellings, and in some cases that meant different first names. Even sources like the Los Angeles Times would spell her name one way, and then the next day in another article, they'd spell it completely differently.
Those articles from, for example, like the Los Angeles Times, were they by different authors, or was it the same author misspelling her name in different articles?
A lot of the articles they came across didn't actually have authors attached to them. So they were just based on a press release or maybe someone going to court, but it wasn't a specific person. So that's a hard one to answer. The victim's name in this case is Idema, I-D-E-M-A, Cerny. Her maiden name was Mitchell, and I was able to use that to verify her name with the 1930 U.S. Census. So I do know I have the right person. But for example, in many newspapers, her name is spelled as Idemea, Idema, Idemea, and even as Idema. So all kind of the same letters, but just in different places. Obviously, this is 90 years ago, but we always want to respect the victim, so it was just kind of a frustrating thing to see. On October 22nd, 1932, a prospector in the Mojave Desert found a nude body of a woman decomposing on the desert sand. Prospectors in California are a common pair, and after the gold rush began to wane, a lot of prospecting moved to the desert, including the Mojave Desert. Prospectors in the 1930s were often backed by large mining businesses and corporations, and they mined for everything from gold to silver to copper and borax, which was actually a huge business in the Mojave Desert. It was hard work, and one of the reasons ghost towns exist. I had never really thought about why there are a lot of ghost towns in the desert, but apparently someone would find a mine, there'd be a big boom, a little town would spring up, and when everything was cleared out of that mine, people would just move on to the next discovery. The body was discovered outside of Victorville, California, a town in San Bernardino County, which is to the east of Los Angeles. And according to thediggings.com, which is a site that collects information and history about mining activity across the United States, there are over 6,000 mines in that area. While I don't have an exact address or location where the victim was found, it sounded like a place that was more desolate, possibly an area people might camp, but certainly not an area in the desert that was highly traversed. In fact, when investigators from Victorville came to the scene, they determined the body had been there for at least a couple of days without being found. Victorville is a city we've talked about briefly in the episode about Mark Titch and Brett Thomas. They were caught in the 1970s just outside Victorville when their car broke down. That car broke down on Interstate 15, a road that leads to much of the western United States and probably afforded them an opportunity to run from the crimes they had committed in Orange County. Victorville is a much different town in the 70s than it is in 1932 when this crime occurs. In fact, according to history on Victorville's own site, most of their population growth happened after the town was incorporated in 1962. That year it had a population of 8,110 people, and it quickly grew. In 2019, its population was over 120,000 people. If you know Victorville now in 2022, then know that in 1932, when this victim was found, it was an entirely different and much, much smaller town.
That is a huge difference. I mean, even though it's a long time from 62 to 2019, that is a big jump, no matter what.
Yeah, it's like we've talked about before, too, a lot of the rapid growth that happens in a lot of parts of California around the 70s, but that's, like you said, John, that's a huge jump even for some of the places we've talked about.
Right.
It also differed in another big way. In 1932, Interstate 15 had yet to be built. Instead, Route 66, which had just been commissioned in 1926, and parts of which wouldn't be fully paved until the late 1930s, was the main road through the area. This road connected Los Angeles and Chicago, Illinois directly for the very first time and was part of the American highway system that was being built. It was a huge deal, and this road was used by Midwesterners who moved to California during the Depression, and it was called the Mother Road by John Steinbeck in The Grapes of Wrath, according to the National Museum of American History. Route 66 is a famous road with lots of songs and books and art and the whole deal. It runs from California through 8 states, including New Mexico, Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, and Illinois. This route went directly through the town of Victorville and will have actual implications for the crime in this case. When investigators got to the scene where the victim was found, they immediately had some obstacles before them. The victim was nude, and there was nothing that identified them anywhere near the body. In fact, there wasn't anything near the body at all, except for a tire flap underneath the victim. Investigators will say that the tire flap matched one that went to a roadster from the time period, but not much else is shared about it. And the roadster will come up a couple of times. They will always call it a roadster. And Charles, I think you're going to tell us a little bit about what kind of vehicle that is.
Yeah, roadster is just, it's kind of a generic term for a larger car that people would take out on longer trips. Now that the interstate's being built and you have a lot more families being able to afford cars, this is the time that, you know, Henry Ford said that you could buy any Ford you wanted as long as it was black. And the traditional roadster, if you think of like a larger model A, Model T, it's got the rumble seat in the back. So you have the kind of the four front seats or the two bench seats, and then this extra seat in the that would be kind of above where the trunk is. So this is what the family would pile in, and you'd drive out to the beach or you'd go on extended car trips. And this is kind of the time period too where America is falling in love with a car. More and more families are having cars, and they're using these cars to go on extended road trips, and i.e. why you'd call it the Roadster.
There isn't a lot shared regarding this particular piece of evidence. What I will say is that it was becoming more and more common, as Charles just said, for people to own vehicles. But those numbers went down because car sales waned during the Depression. So in 1931 and 1932, the year this happens in particular, car sales go kind of down the tubes with everybody kind of struggling. According to the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, which is a department of the United States government, in 1932, 19.5% of Americans had a vehicle. This is very different to us now. By 2012, approximately 81% of people in America owned a vehicle. So this evidence might seem like it might not be as important, especially now as cars litter highways, but they might be able to find a match for it, just knowing that there's less cars out there. It seems plausible.
Do you know if people had to have driver's license or like even have their car registered?
They did. I had never really thought about this, but I looked this up because I was curious as well. In 1914, they did start doing license plates. So cars had license plates, and every year you would get the whole license plate, because there weren't stickers like we have them now where you register. The DMV was also around at the same time, which is crazy to think about that it goes back that far. But even before that, in California, you had to register things like buggies and wagons. And it's just so weird to think about because it's the West and you think of it being lawless. But basically the whole time you have to register whatever vehicle you're driving around. It was determined that the victim was female and that she had been badly battered. Due to the beating she suffered and being in the desert for several days, which meant decomposition and predation, that made it difficult to find any identifying features on the victim. One of the only things they could tell is that the victim was redheaded. In 2022, investigators in a case like this might use DNA to help identify a body. Obviously, that isn't an option in 1932, but you might be surprised how much science played a role in not just identifying this victim, but doing it quickly. I know I was really surprised. The body of the victim is taken to Victorville, and there the coroner takes Bertillon measurements of the victim. The Bertillon system was created by a French police officer named Alphonse Bertillon. Bertillon is actually famous in the world of forensics. He lived and worked and ultimately researched this field in the 1880s. The thing I found really interesting about Bertillon is that when he begins his work in the criminal field, what he's most bothered by is kind of the chaos that police files are in. They're using photography already, but there aren't any standards. They're tracking criminals using names, which means criminals can basically say they're whoever they feel like being that day. They're constantly using fake names. And there's just no way to track people to help victims or to even see if someone has committed multiple crimes. Among the things he's famous for is he's responsible for the creation of the mugshot, or at least the standardization of the mugshot. So instead of a haphazard photo, the pictures we've seen a million times, the person facing the camera from the shoulder up, and then one of the person facing to the side from the shoulders up, he's responsible for creating that standard. He also helped create the standard for how lighting and angles should be used. And of course, this is just something I'd never thought about before, why mugshots look the way that they do.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that even the lighting and the distance, the camera, and the angle that you're taking, all of that would affect the way a picture looks. So it's important to have that all equal.
Yeah, and it helps with people sharing information as well. Right. You know what you're getting when you ask for a mugshot. It's weird to think about, but it's amazing that someone came up with those ideas.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how, I mean, just looking at the times, we started somewhere. I mean, these cars, the cars that that they had in 1932 are obviously a lot different than they are now. So it's like, you know, it's just really neat to see how things progress. And some things that we take for granted, like, oh, yeah, this will make it a lot easier if it's more organized instead of just a bunch of stuff. And one guy did it, which was pretty cool.
And also interesting how, like you said, Sean, some stuff changes, but a lot of stuff doesn't. Like, mugshots, you know, families taking their vacations in cars, or, you know, like a police officer looking for forensic evidence to identify a victim. It's just the tools and the methods are refined and get better.
In an effort to be able to identify criminals by something other than their name, Bertillon also created a system of measurements that was used to identify criminals, and here it'll be used to identify the victim. The system includes taking 5 measurements of the body. They are the length of the head, the width or breadth of the head, the length of the middle finger, the length of the left foot, and the length of the cubit, or your forearm from your elbow to the end of your middle finger. The basic idea is that humans are unique, and if you took these measurements, you'd be able to identify a person. They'd have unique measurements. They also included other identifying characteristics in the files, such as, you know, tattoos or scars, eye color, things like that. And a lot of this is really based on debunked science. People aren't as unique as we like to think that they are. Their bodies are always changing as well. And so once fingerprinting comes along, this basically gets, it's not used as often. But for this episode, this system worked really well. And what's amazing about this system is that it didn't just include these measurements, but it included a whole way to catalog these measurements so that they were searchable. These measurements, like the mugshots, wouldn't do anyone any good if you couldn't extract the information when you needed it. So he essentially created a filing system that made narrowing down those possibilities easier. So in this case, they take the measurements from the victim and they send them to the Sacramento to the State Bureau of Identification. And within a day or two in 1932, this victim is identified. And this is amazing to me. I can only imagine how many files are in the State Bureau of Identification from all over California. If you're thinking about people who have files there from just LA or San Bernardino, there's so many people living in those areas that they are able to narrow down with 100% accuracy who this victim is, and to do it with just a couple of days, just, it blew me away. On top of the Bertillon measurements, the coroner of Victorville was also able to get fingerprints. Once the body begins to decompose, it starts to lose water. So to do this, he took a hypodermic needle and injected water into the fingers so that they would replump. Once they were plumped, he took fingerprints and they were able to match those with the file they found using the Bertillon measurements. So just another way to make sure that's who their victim was.
So almost like cross-referencing. Like, we're pretty sure it's this person, but this fingerprint gives us 100% identifiable.
Yeah. The measurements and the fingerprints matched 21-year-old Idema Cerny. There was a file at the State Bureau of Identification because Idema Cerny had been arrested in July of 1930, 2 years prior for robbery. I don't know if she served any time or went to trial, but they cataloged her information. According to that file, she was found with 2 other men at the time of the robbery, her husband Gus Cerny and another man named Jack Yelvington. At the time of Idema's murder, the newspaper notes that Yelvington was in San Quentin, so investigators turn towards finding her husband.
At this time, are they looking at Gus as a potential suspect, or is it more, does the paper say they were looking at him for, like, to contact the next of kin?
At this time, I think they're just going through the motions. They've now identified this victim, so now they're trying to find where they live, who, you know, their next of kin is. So probably to let them know, but also as part of the investigation process, right. I think. So they haven't named him as a possible suspect.
Chances are the last person to see Idema alive was her husband. So therefore we need to find her husband.
And this is just the information that's readily available in her file because that's what they find first. So like I said, I don't know much about that 1930 crime. I do know it was an armed holdup, but she was about 19 at the time. Yelvington, who was found with her, was also 19, and Cerny, who was her husband, would have been about 21. Yelvington will go on to commit more crimes before being arrested again. He's actually referred to as the baby bandit. We will have a picture of him on our website because as soon as you see it, you will know exactly why he's referred to that way. He signs a confession to several robberies, and then weirdly, the police take him to lunch, and after lunch, he makes a run for it. And he gets shot in front of a bunch of people who start to riot. They have to put out a riot call, and then he just goes back to jail. It's a really weird story, but
I just love the fact that the cops took him out for lunch, and he decided to dine and dash.
Yeah, it was weird to me that he admitted several robberies using a weapon, holding people at gunpoint, and then they're like, okay, let's go to lunch. But I just thought I'd mention it because it's so odd. One of the perks of identifying Ideema Cerny so quickly is that the investigators can hopefully find a crime scene, which, as we've seen in other cases, can be crucial to finding answers and also future trials. Ideema and Gus Cerny had only been married about 18 months and were married in Tijuana. At the time of her murder, she had been living in Los Angeles in the Belvedere neighborhood with Cerny and was working as a waitress. Gus had, according to newspaper, worked as a telephone lineman, and the first step in investigating this crime was going to her home. The Cernys lived at 3037 Laclede Avenue in Los Angeles, and different newspapers described their home both as a cottage or a shack. The house is no longer there, but I do have a picture of it at the time that she was murdered, so we'll put that on our website. It does look more like a really run-down garage. It was a small home with three rooms, and when police arrived on the scene, there was no one home. Once inside, what they found was evidence of a brutal crime. In the bedroom, there was blood all around the room, including the bed and a pillowcase soaked through with blood. On the front lawn, there were tire marks as if a vehicle had driven up to the front door. All of Ideema Cerny's belongings, including her clothes and makeup, were in the home, but like Gus Cerny, his belongings were missing and his clothes had been cleaned out. A neighbor reported hearing them fight, and that the two of them definitely lived together. That will kind of come up as an issue later. It also turns out that Gus Cerny had a blue roadster, and the two were missing. But inside the home, investigators found his rumble seats taken out of the vehicle. And again, the rumble seats are the seats in the far back of the roadster. They sit over the trunk, and they're there for extra people who want to sit in the car. But if you were to take them out, there'd be room for you to store more things. Everything they find at the home leads investigators to believe that the main suspect in this case is Gus Cerny. It appears to them as if Ideema Cerny was attacked in her home, and then her husband put her in the rumble seat of his car, taking her body to the desert before driving away. And that suspicion deepens when they meet his family and interview them. On October 26th, 4 days after she was found by a prospector, murdered on the side of the road, Ideema Cerny's family-in-law arrives at the Victorville morgue to identify her body. Her mother-in-law, sister-in-law, and brother-in-law positively identified her. We will have a picture of her on our site, and the only characteristic that the newspaper continues to give is that she has red hair. The family also tells investigators that Ideema and Gus were supposed to have traveled to Palm Springs on October 17th. On October 17th, Ideema and Gus had gone to Monrovia, where much of his family lives, and where it seems I think that she had actually lived at one time as well. They had dinner with Gus's brother and his family at their home. Gus had two brothers, one worked as a barber and one as a policeman. His brother, who was a policeman, had worked in Monrovia as a policeman and had only recently started working in San Fernando. Monrovia is in Los Angeles County and located in the San Gabriel Mountains and is east of Pasadena and northeast of Los Angeles. It would have been about a 17 to 23-mile drive from Ideema Cerny's home in Los Angeles. After that dinner, the family had expected the couple had gone to Palm Springs, and they hadn't heard from them since. The family also gave police a possible motive in the crime. Gus Cerny's mother so that Ideema was supposed to have inherited a significant amount of money from her family's estate when she turned 21, which she had just done a few months earlier in June of 1932. The inheritance was set to be about $15,000 or so, but they believe that she had never collected that inheritance. And just to give you guys an idea how much that really is, at that time, it would be about $314,000 now.
It's interesting how she's arrested for robbery. She lives in like a shack, but she's supposedly supposed to get the equivalent of $314,000 real soon. But if that's true, like the parents were like, all right, you go slum it and then we'll give you some money. Like, it just seems very odd.
It could have been like put in a trust, you know? I mean, she's still relatively young, right?
But she just seems to be living so hard for someone that came from a supposedly wealthy family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting case because, like you said, they are not living in a very well-off house, and yet they have a roadster, which is not a cheap item at the time.
No, it would have been an expensive car.
when the investigators go and talk to their bank, they say that Adema comes in to cash her paycheck and her husband's paycheck, but they don't have any money in the bank. So it is this kind of odd thing where she supposedly has an inheritance that she can collect. We'll talk about that in a second, but it's very different from the life that she's living. And I can't tell, because her parents don't really play a part in the articles, if they have, both of them have passed on and this is money they've left to her, because there's an entirely different person, which we'll talk about in a second, who's kind of in charge of those funds until she comes of age. Or if, like you're saying, it's a trust that she just gets at a certain age and she's out here in Los Angeles. I believe she was born in Chicago, Illinois. So she's out here in Los Angeles, you know, living life as a waitress, taking care of herself. And
well, there's plenty of people. And I think we all, I mean, we've all, let's say, maybe not necessarily always great with money. You know, I mean, their run-ins with the law aside, you know, spends all their money on a nice car, maybe, you know, cashes their paycheck, goes out to eat, you know, lives it up, you know.
And it gets a little stranger because her mother-in-law also says that Adema had $800, which she had kept a secret from her husband, and about $4,000 worth of jewels. So it seems police, when they look for these things, they don't find the money, and there's never confirmation about this level of jewels. And just to give you an idea, $800 would be equivalent to about $16,000 now, and $4,000 in jewels would be about $84,000. So
could it be that maybe did you find anything about Gus maybe having a gambling problem or any other problem where she's hiding money, because she's cashing checks and then it goes away, it seems like?
Yeah, it seems like, well, the bank seems to think that they're living paycheck to paycheck when she's cashing these checks. So I mean, they're paying for their rent and things like that. Gus Cerny, in a few minutes, the police will find out that he has a very extensive criminal history. And so that's definitely a possibility. Like what you're saying, maybe he spends it in another way. It's also, I think, a very big possibility that he gets money in an unethical or in an illegal way.
Gotcha.
Detectives also learned that the area where Adema was found was a common place Gus Cerny had camped, and that he knew the area very well. The Cerny family was concerned, and they believe that something terrible may have happened to Gus, possibly that he was killed or kidnapped by the same person who hurt Adema. But by the end of the conversation with the family, mixed with the forensics, investigators put out official notice that they're looking for Gus Cerny as a suspect in the murder of Adema Cerny. They also narrow down the day of Adema Cerny's death based on conversations with the family and with neighbors. They believe she was killed on October 18th, or very early on the 19th, and that her body was left in the desert on October 19th in the morning. An officer in Monrovia tells detectives that he saw Gus Cerny in Monrovia on October 20th, and he was alone. And it makes sense that police officers, you know, they would know his family and his brother who worked with them, would recognize him in town. Investigators also learned that Cerny was a rum runner and had acquaintances in Chicago. Investigators don't give details about Cerny's rum running, but this is an interesting part of his life and also regarding things going on at the time. Prohibition, which for those not from the United States, refers to the 18th Amendment to our Constitution, which outlawed alcohol from 1920 to 1933. One of the big impacts of this law was that it fueled something very much associated with the 1930s, and that's crime families in places like Chicago, New York, and also in Los Angeles. These organizations were dedicated to providing and running alcohol to people and establishments running illegally. And when this crime happens, it would be before that law is overturned. In Los Angeles, just to give an for instance, in any given year, there were about 30,000 illegal underground speakeasies or bars where alcohol was sold. Whole industries sprang up around these places, and even more criminal activity like gambling and sex work. It's also really fascinating how this worked in Los Angeles, and many of the police were actually in on it. In fact, one of Los Angeles's major crime boss was also a vice cop. It appears that Gus Cerny had a daily job as well as a dangerous job running alcohol through LA, and it would make sense that he also had ties to organized crime here in California and maybe even in Chicago. The other thing that is interesting here is that while many large and small American cities had an underground network of bars and facilities which required rum runners or people being bringing them alcohol, a lot of the alcohol was made in smaller or less populated areas. So for instance, I just did a post today on our social media about a still operation in Newman, California. That's an area of California that's very rural. So people there are making alcohol and either selling it off their farm or sending it to other places. But even more alcohol came from places like the desert. So places around California, places like Arizona and Nevada, and roads like Route 66 would be so important to connecting people like Gus Cerny to hidden places where alcohol was being made. And it also means that he would have a pretty good knowledge of this road. To investigators, it looked like Gus Cerny murdered his wife on the 18th or 19th, then drove to Monrovia and, taking Route 66, drove in a straight shot to the edge of Victorville, where he left Idima's body, and then had a straight shot to Chicago as a getaway. Route 66 connected Chicago and Los Angeles, but it would still be about a 1,400-mile-plus trip, which Google Maps says would take about 22 hours without any stopping at all. But in the 1930s, I think it would take a little more time than that. A roadster, and I saw different speeds for this, so if you're a car person, let us know. I saw it, that they could go upwards of 80 miles per hour, but that reliably they could do 40 to 65 miles per hour. Obviously, I don't know what size tank that is, but you have to stop for gas a bunch. And
they're big cars, and they hold a lot of gas, but you also don't get the gas mileage that most modern cars do too. But this is also the time that you do see a lot of like roadside stands. I mean, it's pretty close to the start of like what we would consider like drive-ins, starting around that time too. So, I mean, it's a long trip.
And to think going in a car from 1932 at 40 to 65 miles an hour on areas that aren't paved and how the suspension is probably horrible, that would be the worst pain for 1,400 miles, even on the paved areas. Sometimes when you have just a little bit of an alignment problem, the whole car shakes and you're doing that for 20 minutes and your whole body feels like it's been shaking the whole time. I couldn't imagine driving a 1932 car at 65 miles an hour for 1,400 miles. That must be a horrible trip.
Hi there, nerdlings. I'm Ash.
And I'm Nat. We're the host of Crimetime Nerds, a podcast that focuses on lesser-known investigations, unsolved cases, serial killers, and small-town crimes. Join us as we pick up our flashlights and begin our search for answers as we venture down those dark true crime paths together.
Join us every Sunday as we explore the nature of these often heinous and heartbreaking cases. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can visit our website at crimetimenerds.com or follow our social media platforms. Don't forget to trust your gut, and we hope you join us each and every week.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
There is very little information on Idima Cerny. She was only 21 when she was murdered, and it does appear that she grew up in Chicago, Illinois area. There isn't very much information about her parents and how she first met Gus Cerny, for instance. She did have an inheritance and a guardian named W.J. Schumacher, who worked for the Southern California Fence Company. According to him, she had not collected on her inheritance, and she could have. She turned 21. She was owed it. But she had gone and taken out a few hundred dollars here and there. So that might actually be the $800 that Gus Cerny's mother was talking about. Idima also had ties to Monrovia, and investigators speak with an aunt who worked at a sanitarium in the area, though they don't share any personal information that they have gotten from her. So that's kind of the only information we ever get about her family at all, is this single aunt. When detectives talk with Idina Cerny's friends, or at least co-workers, remember she worked as a waitress, they confirm that Idina and Cerny were married in Tijuana in 1931 and that she kept their marriage a secret from her family for fear of being cut off. Again, I can't tell you if her parents were alive or if they've passed on or if there were conditions on the inheritance. Investigators will note several times that Gus Cerny knew about that inheritance before they were married, and it does appear that she had kept, that she could actually get to it, a secret from him. On October 29th, the police issued a warrant for Gus Cerny's arrest. They also tell police in Illinois and Iowa that they're looking for him, and specifically Chicago, where he has connections. While they continue the manhunt for Cerny, detectives in Los Angeles catch a break when they receive a letter from a woman in Carbondale, Illinois. This woman tells police that she is Gus Cerny's wife and that she's been married to him for several years, and in fact, they have a child together who is 6.
So that means Gus had the child when he was 15 or 16?
He's 23 in 1932, so I think about 17.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It seems Gus Cerny has been to see her, and she has many questions about the charges against him. But now police know approximately where Gus Cerny is, and on top of being a suspected murderer, it appears that he's also a bigamist. Whether or not Idina Cerny knew that Gus had been married before, before they got married, it's not something that they ever share with the newspaper. But this information helps narrow down where Gus Cerny is, as I said, and it also is perhaps offers police another motive. Detectives get in touch with police in Chicago, and a stakeout is set up. They find out that Gus is receiving money from family members, and they wait for him to cash a money order at a telegraph office. Just as they expect, he goes to the office, and he's arrested by Chicago police. Initially, Gus Cerny claims he's innocent of both the charges of murder and of bigamy. When he's arrested, he still also has his blue roadster with him. When interrogated by Chicago detectives, they tell him that they found blood in the rumble seat. And according to them, this causes Cerny to just completely fold, and he gives a full confession. Oddly, Chicago investigators also do something that, I don't know, just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. They take Cerny in Cerny's blue roadster to the Navy Pier on Lake Michigan. And the purpose of this is so that Cerny can use that pier to reenact the crime.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense of why would you take a suspect in a murder case out to a pier to reenact a murder that he probably committed in a desert, or at least in a place that was not near water, and then disposed of a body in the desert.
Yeah, I mean, he's not going to go to trial in Chicago. He's going to come back here to Los Angeles. So it just, the whole thing didn't make a lot of sense to me. And I mean, I don't know what happens if he tells Chicago police one thing, but then changes his mind. And he doesn't fight extradition, so they don't have to prove to a judge or anything that he's committed this crime. So it just seemed just like a waste of everyone's time. But this is what Cerny tells Chicago police, according to Cerny's confession. He says that he and Idina argued the night of October 18th. He says that during the fight, he left and came back to the house at about 10 p.m., when he entered the home, he found his wife, Idina, in bed. He then went out to his car where he retrieved a leaf spring, walked back inside, and hit her in the head with it. And just to give you an idea, a leaf spring is a part of a vehicle. It's several metal strips hooked together and curved that helps with suspension. So it's certainly a formidable weapon and would be very heavy and dangerous, especially used this way, kind of as a bat.
Did it ever mention what they argued about?
It does not, and Gus Cerny will say that he doesn't remember murdering her. He doesn't remember why he did it or what they were arguing about. After he hit her once, she rolled out of bed and onto a carpet where he rolled her up and put her in the roadster in the rumble seat. This is a horrible confession for many reasons. Just terrible what he did to his wife. But investigators also believe that he's leaving certain things out. For instance, they think she was beat far more than just once in the head. There also isn't a motive shared. That motive is heavily believed to be connected to the inherited money Idina had not shared with her husband. Investigators also mentioned that other weapons may have been involved, including a tire iron and maybe a tool Cerny used at his job as a lineman. According to Cerny, he then drove to City Hall in Los Angeles with Idina in the rumble seat of his car, and he sat there outside the building for about 30 minutes trying to decide what to do. At some point after the murder, he also stopped to get his paycheck. He cleaned up the house and took her body to the desert. Cerny also mentions that there's a lot about the night he doesn't remember, as I said, and he doesn't know how he could have committed this crime, and he doesn't understand even why he did it. Gus Cerny waived extradition, and two officers from Los Angeles flew to Chicago to formally arrest him and bring him back. They were Detective Lieutenants Joe Filkus and Bill Baggett. And just a little interesting history on Lieutenant Filkus. In 1935, he will be the lead of a brand new task force that's created after the LAPD have to investigate some pretty similar crimes and murders like Adema's that involved women and children. And this is a big deal because it's part of the history of further understanding crimes motivated by domestic violence and crimes committed by intimate partners against both women and children.
It does say something about how common those crimes must have been for the LAPD to say, well, we need specialists on this.
And I want to stop here so we can take a moment to discuss the motive in this case. It seems clear in the newspapers that investigators believe the motive was money. But now that they've learned he's a bigamist, they think that motive might have extended farther back to also being the reason he married Adema in the first place. That he had always planned one way or another to get her money. So either murder her for her money or con her out of her money.
That's hard because I don't really know, because what if he just tried to move on and just left that lady in Chicago and then this is just his new start? I feel like in the 30s, it's a lot easier just to sneak out in the middle of the night and you're able to just go away and, you know, start a whole brand new life. And I can understand that if he knew the money, but at the same time, in his confession, he said he left for 2 hours. What did he do then?
Yeah, but don't forget, he was being helped by family. I think that to me is a little bit more of a red flag too, of that he was out for his money, out for her as a mark to get her money.
Yeah, but his family lived in Los Angeles area. So it was like, what I'm saying is running away from his old wife could still be an easy possibility since his family wasn't really in Chicago.
But he was, we don't know that because because he was getting money in Chicago from family. Was that, do we know whether that family was in Chicago or was it in Cal? All it said was just that money was given to him.
It just said family, yeah.
Right.
So I'm not really sure, you know, if it's someone he was related to there in Chicago or if he's at an office where people could send you money. So I'm thinking maybe also could have been his family in California. What I will say is, I mean, they never say whether or not she knew that she had been married before. In the 30s and the 20s, this is a big time for marriage cons. For people to, I mean, we talked about Emma Ledoux. I mean, this is a big part of what she's doing. So I always see bigamy charges, especially when someone has not just married someone, you know, because there's that moral aspect to it, I guess. But I care less about that than the fraudulent aspect. If you've married someone else, but you haven't told that person that you're married, or you're marrying them with the intent of stealing their money, which is pretty common, especially after the Depression and things like that.
Well, and the frustrating part of this, some of the information not being reported by the newspapers at the time of whether Adema knew about the first wife or the first wife knew about Adema, you know, where did they really meet? Did they meet in Chicago and they came out here? Did he meet her and then marry her out in California?
Yeah, it's hard. We have all these cases where the person left behind is, in a lot of our episodes, who tells the story is the person who's committed the crime. And So it's very difficult to know for sure how truthful that story is, how much they actually accurately remember, or how much
trying to paint themselves in a better picture.
Sure, yeah. It's just difficult to know. And it's impossible to know what was happening in their marriage. I think there are some red flags just in what was reported. Her hiding money from her husband, for instance, mm-hmm. might point to her planning to leave him. But while we can't really, you know, guess for sure what was happening, we can see similarities in this murder to many, many others at the time and since. Researching this crime led me to wonder about the possible connection between intimate partner murders and domestic violence. Domestic violence is, of course, a very difficult topic and even more difficult to describe. Our understanding of that crime, the crime of domestic violence, is much different now than I think even when we were younger. According to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, domestic violence or intimate partner violence is, quote, a pattern of behaviors used by one partner to maintain power and control over another partner in an intimate relationship. This can include physical violence, but it can also include threats, emotional abuse, and financial control. And one of the most important things, I think, modern domestic violence study has learned, something called coercive control, where a person is trying to control your behavior, who you can talk to. They can do that through violence or through verbal abuse. There's just a whole lot of layers to domestic violence that's particular to each case. But just to give you an understanding of the scope of the problem, according to the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, from 1980 to 2008, 1 in 5 people were killed by an intimate partner. But when you look at the stats separating out gender, and during this time, they're only going to have the two genders. So it isn't our intention to leave anyone out, because intimate partner violence can happen to anyone, anywhere, anytime. But when you look at those two stats and you separate it out for women, the numbers get a lot worse. In 2013, 15 times as many females were murdered by a male they know than were killed by male strangers. So we often spend a lot of time talking about stranger danger and the things that happen there, but women are more vulnerable in their own homes. And one of the people at the forefront of studying and talking about intimate partner murder and its warning signs and possible connections to intimate partner violence is Dr. Jane Monckton Smith, who's a professor of public protection at the University of Gloucestershire in the United Kingdom. I'm choosing to talk about her research because even though it's based primarily in the UK, it's being used all around the world. And of course, it's spurring even more research into the area. I'll have links to all of her papers and her books, some YouTube videos, as well as some other academic papers in the United States as well, and the CDC. Dr. Monckton Smith studied cases in the United Kingdom where victims were killed by their partners and focused as well on information about those relationships in the lead up to those crimes. She looked at more than 400 murders, and what she found is that almost in every case, there were 8 steps that occurred before those murders. So even though we don't know what happened to Aidima, what we can say is that it's highly likely she may have experienced some of these things as well. They're really common when an intimate partner commits murder, especially when the victim is a woman and the murderer is a man. And the goal here is to understand what she was going through, but also to have a better understanding of intimate partner murder in general, and maybe even someday an ability to keep these kinds of murders from happening. So the 8 things that happen in the lead up to these murders are a history of stalking or abuse by a perpetrator, a romance that has developed quickly into a serious relationship, a relationship dominated by coercive control, so threats, violence, keeping you from seeing loved ones, a trigger that threatens the perpetrator's control, so maybe someone has decided to leave and they begin to think about, they feel threatened that they can't control the person any longer and what they're going to do next, which creates an escalation or increase both in intensity or frequency of the partner's control, and a change in the thinking by the perpetrator, eventually, you know, maybe a decision to move on, but the only way that they can do that is by ending the relationship, usually sometimes in a homicide. And there's often planning that goes into it, planning or buying weapons, looking for a way out, and then in the end, the partner has been killed. In a BBC News article on Dr. Monckton Smith called Domestic Abuse Killers Follow 8-Stage Pattern, study says, she talks about the idea of intimate partner crimes being called, quote, crimes of passion. I think that's kind of what you're seeing here in this case. We've definitely seen other crime scenes that are very violent, and they're described this way, that the person must much care because so much effort and violence went into the situation. And in these cases, people will often describe the perpetrator as someone who would, you know, who would never do this. It came out of nowhere. And in fact, Gus Cerny's own defense is really similar to ones that she's seen before in other cases, that he doesn't know why he's committed this crime. He doesn't really remember it. But in her research, Dr. Monckton Smith finds that in a high percentage of these exact kind of cases, there is planning, it's thought out, it's not a sudden burst or surprising bit of violence. In fact, that violence often is, you could use it to characterize the entire relationship. There are, of course, more studies going to better understand this type of crime. And I just hope to keep talking about it because it's not just a U.S. thing or a U.K. thing. It's a worldwide situation. According to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, an average 137 women across the world are killed by a partner or family member every single day. On November 27, 1932, Cerny was back in LA and officially charged with murder and bigamy. On top of these charges, a grand jury was also convened in regard to the murder charges and they returned an indictment. On December 5th, 1932, Cerny was arraigned and pleaded not guilty before the LA Superior Court to all of the charges. He also enters a second plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. And again, his defense is that he doesn't really remember the crime. He doesn't understand why he would do it. It's out of his character, so he must have been insane. And I know it's really difficult to know, it's so long ago, but do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I find it interesting because I think a lot of people seem to talk about that sometimes. I remember that one case of Lawrence Singleton. He completely said, I don't remember anything I did. Like that kind of defense where I don't remember anything I did. This is that case because I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting defense, but I feel like people say it a lot.
Yeah. It's one of those things where I'm sure it exists, but it's hard to know who's telling the truth. I mean, I guess that's the court system in general. Who do you believe? But
I don't necessarily think I would believe that defense. I think given the fact that she's got this amount of money, that he's connected to organized crime, even the past bank robbery, taking that out of the equation, I think this was a premeditated act, planning to get rid of her for her money.
So you're with the police on this one. You kind of seen the same things. So. His plea doesn't last long. A hearing is convened to talk about his sanity, and three court-appointed alienists testify that based on their exams with Cerny, he's absolutely sane. This attempt, especially to say that he doesn't remember or that he's insane, is an attempt to sidestep a possible death penalty case, which in California at the time would have meant a hanging. But with a judgment of sane and basically no defense, Cerny changes his plea from not guilty by reason of sanity to, you know, then to not guilty, and then ultimately he pleads guilty.
And an alienist, in case somebody was not familiar with that term, is the term for psychiatrists before psychiatrists was a common.
Yeah, and like psychoanalysis, right? Like right. Specifically. On February 14th, 1933, Superior Court Judge Aguilar holds a hearing to decide on punishment and specifically the death sentence versus life in jail with the possibility of parole. The differences in these two sentences, I know we've talked about this before, but it's vast. Without a death sentence, Gus Cerny will have the possibility to apply for parole just 10 years after he murdered his wife. And that's what happens here. The judge hears from witnesses on both sides, and after taking that into consideration, he sentences 23-year-old Gus Cerny to life in prison with parole in San Quentin Prison. On January 17th, 1933, just a few months after he beat 21-year-old Idema Cerny to death and left her body nude in the desert, Gus Cerny left LA County Jail on the weekly prison train to San Quentin Prison. What happens to him after that, I can't tell you. The newspaper only once covers his application for parole, but he files it before the 10 years is up. So they basically deny it, but they also say just, you know, reapply in a couple years. And based on other crimes we've researched from this time period, I imagine as long as he's doing everything he needs to do in jail, he probably is paroled.
I still find it the piece that doesn't quite fit is Gus Cerny's family. And I think it's just the fact of them not knowing that he's married to the woman in Chicago with a child, and then giving him money while he's on the run after they've been notified by the police that he's a person of interest. So it makes me, I guess, there's a part of me that thinks that, yeah, they were more involved than initially reported. But
what's weird with that is that they also sat there and told the cops how, yeah, she's got all this jewelry worth $4,000 and this money. So it's like they're almost giving the cops a motive of why Gus killed her. So it's,
yeah, they,
like,
knew a lot about her finances without.
Right. So it's like it could go either way on the family,
yeah.
Of,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
What are they doing?
Yeah, it is. I don't know. And I guess it's family. So, I mean, some families know. It's not something I talk about with my family very much, is like finances, you know, like I'm not going to talk to
unless them. She was open to them. What if she didn't have any family around, so she was actually open to his family.
But she's also keeping some money secret. I don't know. Yeah, I think that's the biggest question I still have on this one is A, obviously what happened to Gus Cerny after he was paroled, or was he paroled? And then what was the family's involvement in this past what was reported in the papers?
A case like this in the 1930s is interesting for many reasons. The science they used is different and yet still really familiar. The roads and cars involved were all brand new and cutting edge and yet hard to imagine. But there's also something frustratingly similar, and that's the fact that Edema Cerny was killed by someone she knew. We could surely tell this story in any place during any time period in America and never run out of victims. She was disposed of on the side of the road in the desert, all alone, by her husband, a man who had made promises and vows on the day they were wed only 18 months prior. Edema Cerny lived so little life before someone she loved placed their greed before her very existence. Like every victim who came after her, she deserved more from the people she loved, and more from a society in which this kind of crime is still far too common.
If you or someone you know need help with domestic violence, you can call the Domestic Violence Hotline in America at 1-800-799-SAFE. It's always free and confidential, and they speak over 200 languages. You can also go to their website at thehotline.org. For a list of services for where you live, as well as an alternative ways to contact them, including by text or chatting online.
Sharing our cold case for this episode is Sean.
Our cold case for this episode comes from the Doe Network and the cold case site for the San Bernardino Sheriffs. On May 14th, 1991, an unidentified person was found deceased in the Mojave Desert alongside the I-40 about 30 miles west of Needles, California. It was determined they had been deceased for several days, and investigators believe the cause of death was homicide. The victim's identity is still unknown, but according to the Doe Network, the body was biologically female, between the ages of 24 and 45 years old, Caucasian, standing 5'4". Approximately 148 pounds with brown hair. A sketch of the deceased is available and will be posted to our site. When she was found, the victim was wearing a pink tank top with a picture of a cactus and a sunflower on the front. Pink knee-length leggings with a lace fringe and white socks. She was also wearing a yellow metal gold chain. There is DNA, fingerprints, and dental records available in this case. If you have any information about the Needles Jane Doe, please contact the San Bernardino Sheriffs at 909-387-3589 or anonymously at 1-800-78-CRIME.
Thank you for listening to this episode of California True Crime on the Darkcast Network. For a full list of our sources as well as more information on this and all of our cases, head to our webpage at californiatruecrime.com. where you can support the show by joining our Patreon, which has options for ad-free episodes. On our website, we have up and running with some California True Crime merchandise, t-shirts, mugs, and special episode exclusive stickers. If you'd like to contact us, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Cali True Crime. Make sure that you subscribe to our show to get our latest episodes. Leave us a 5-star review and tell a friend. Get the word out about California True Crime. We'd like to thank our quality control engineer, Melanie Duncan. This was recorded at Snail Ranch Studios and The Hangar.
It's Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.